2 FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now. Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2 FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies, it's Thursday the 21st of April and this is Game On. Coming up today, Manchester United have got their man. Miguel Delaney and Stephen Elliott discuss the challenges facing Erik ten Hag at Old Trafford. Former Armagh footballer Stephen McDonnell will preview the Ulster Championship and Bernard Jackman and Ali Donnelly will be on hand to look at the weekend's rugby action. Plus, John Kenny is at the Irish Open Championships and we have two tickets to Punchestown to give away. If you want to get in touch, please text us on 51552 or tweet at Game On 2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome along. So the big news today is that Manchester United have confirmed that Erik ten Hag will take over as manager at the end of the season. The impressive Ajax boss is looking to wrap up a third title before moving to Old Trafford on a three-year deal, which includes the option of a further year. I'm delighted to say that Miguel Delaney, sports writer, joins us on the line. Football writer, I should say. Miguel, I think a lot of people were expecting this announcement, but I'm not sure that today was the day that they believed it would happen. The timing does seem quite interesting.
Yeah, especially given less than 48 hours ago, United had one of their worst results of the modern era. So this certainly gets people talking about something else. And to be fair, I think there had been an appreciation that the appointment had moved along a bit more quickly over the past 2 weeks. And the thinking was it would be announced after Ajax's attempt for a double. Now, that attempt for a double falls with the weekend because they lost in the Dutch Cup to PSV Eindhoven, so I suppose that cleared the way a little bit. But yeah, certainly I suppose it helps a few things. And I don't think it's any surprise to anyone at this point, least of all the Manchester United players, because they've been told to prepare for the appointment. So.
Yeah, interesting times ahead, really, for everyone. Stephen Elliott joins us on the line as well. Stephen, do you think that he is the right man for the job?
I think time will tell. I think from a Man United's point of view, I think supporters will be delighted that he's been announced and they know what's happening now come the end of the season. I still question the kind of whole interim appointment of Ralph Rangnick till the end of the season. I'm not too sure that was a good idea. It still may turn out that he may get Champions League football. Like, nobody seems to really want that at the moment. But yeah, I think from a Man United's point of view, after the way the game ended the other night, I think they had to sort something out and have something in place. And it's going to be a big job when he goes in there. There's no doubt about it. All you have to do is look at the standard of the two teams the other night, and you see the job that's at hand. And I think it's one of them. Man United want to be challenging at the top. They won't accept anything else. They're arguably the biggest club in the world. So I think, yeah, he's got a huge job, but if he can turn it around, he could make himself a real hero in Manchester.
So Miguel, the standard bearers at the moment are Liverpool and Manchester City, and it's up to everybody else to try and close that gap as much as possible. So lay it out for us. How big is the challenge facing Ten Hag at Manchester United?
Oh, huge, because, of course, he's not just in a situation that Klopp or Guardiola had. Guardiola in particular, where Guardiola was walking into a club that had basically been entirely constructed for him. United, as Stephen's alluded to there, there's a lot of questions about the infrastructure, how the club's being run. Even yesterday, there was the announcement that they're changing two of the scouts. One of them, Jim Leder, who's worked there years. And that points to the fact that, you know, my manager's far from the only change needed at this club. So, I mean, it's not just about kind of building from a fairly flat base to get United to challenge again. It's a much bigger job than that. It's really about almost galvanising the whole club. And that's why I think there are maybe fair questions about this. And why, as Stephen said, there only time will tell. Because Ten Hag, he did do an excellent job at Ajax, but he's by no means a sure thing, partly because Ajax is such a specific case. I mean, it's almost like a kind of, in terms of the football infrastructure, a lower scale Manchester City, where any manager that works there, they're basically a head coach. They have everything else is looked after. All they have to do is coach. That's not the case at United. It's totally different circumstances. The one thing you would say is that in terms of the pure coaching and what he does with players on the training ground, everyone you speak to who knows Ten Hag says he's exceptional at that. And from that perspective, there's even an argument that this is the first time United have had any manager who's close to that sort of idea in half a decade. Maybe even since Ferguson departed. Solskjaer, I think, with the best will in the world, he was never close to being a top coach. With Mourinho, since he left Chelsea, in fact, almost since he left Real Madrid, there's been ongoing debate over whether he's really at the top of the game anymore, whether his football is 10 years out of date. Similar could be said about Van Gaal and Moyes. Obviously, was probably just not a top level manager in that regard. So from that perspective, and certainly from Solskjaer's time, I think it will be an upgrade. But whether that upgrade is sufficient to get Manchester United challenging is the biggest question of all.
Miguel, where does Ralf Rangnick and his future fit into this puzzle?
I think at this point he will persist. He persists with this consultancy role that had been a condition of his appointment. But I mean, certainly it won't be any sort of central position that had been anticipated could be the case. In terms of the role that Rangnick could have filled, which was sporting director, they're going to go ahead with Mertje and former player Darren Fletcher. They're the kind of main football intelligence of the club. So at most, Rangnick will be a consultant offering advice from outside, and he's already offered some frank advice within the club while he's there now. But I wouldn't be surprised if you see him pitch up at another job in the near future. I mean, the Austrian Federation have already been in touch. As Stephen said, it ended up being a kind of... they could, yes, like a Champions League. I would consider it some way doubtful, but who knows in this race. But it's been a strange period of Rangnick in charge.
Yeah, it really has. So, Stephen, where does Ten Hag start then? Like, what does he need to do and who does he need to get rid of?
I think there's a few players there that you look at them and you kind of... Paul Pogba is the obvious one. He comes to mind. Obviously, the other night didn't work out great for him after coming off after a couple of minutes. There's been loads of talk of him wanting away. So I think what he needs to do, he needs to go into that club again. And listen, there's some good young players there at Man United already, but for some reason, wherever they've lost their confidence, they look a shadow of the players they were like when they come on the scene. Marcus Rashford comes to mind. Like, he'd watching him the other night, his confidence is shot to pieces. Even when he went in one on one with Alisson, he just kind of didn't feel like he was going to control that ball. And I think that's why he needs to go in there and obviously, whatever he has there, kind of get a base of what he has. Young lads, he's been known to kind of. Ten Hag's been known to kind of develop young players in the Dutch league, and I know it's obviously a different ball game coming in. I know Miguel alluded to Ajax being quite a big club and in the Dutch league, but I think it's a different animal coming to Man United, and I think he needs to kind of get the bases and find a way of playing. Like, that's one thing I look at Man United recently. They haven't had really an identity, and I know everybody says identity, work hard is the minimum, but there's no kind of shape to their team in recent years, and you're watching them and players just don't know whether they're coming or going, and it's I'm not like a Man United supporter, but I'm sure Man United fans watching them are looking at the team like between their hands, and they just can't believe what they're seeing. So I think he needs to go in there and get a way of playing, and obviously there's going to have to be a few players removed, but it's not as easy as said and done. There's players there on kind of big contracts on big money, and the way they've been playing in recent times, I'm not sure whether they're going to go elsewhere and pick up the same contracts that they're on at Man United. So again, he's got a big job regarding recruitment wise as well, but I'm sure he's well aware of what's at stake. And I think players like Van de Beek, who's gone on loan to Everton, I'm sure he's looking at him coming into the club and thinking, do you know what, might give him a lift if he comes back to the club. And I don't know, I just think he needs to get that basis of how he want to play and right through the whole club, not just the first team. I feel like this Man United were known for bringing players in and having a way of playing over the years, youth team players coming into the first team squad, and there's been a continuation that in recent years it hasn't been anything. It's just been signing players just kind of hoping that he may do well, and I think that's what he needs to do. He needs to get the identity of the club as a whole sorted quick, and I'm sure he's done that at Ajax. He's been very successful there, but I'm sure he has a plan in place, and like I said earlier on, only time will tell, but somebody has to get it right at Man United. They will not be in the shadows forever, so I think he'll be hoping, and all Man United fans will be hoping, that he is the man to finally do it.
Miguel, just when Rangnick was appointed as the interim boss, there was a huge amount of conversations about style and philosophy, and then of bit of expectation came that we would see a little bit of what Rannick was about, and it just didn't happen. It didn't materialise. It felt like it was over before it almost began. So when you look at Ten Hag coming in, who has the same squad of players, well, right now he does anyway, we'll see what happens. How is he going to be able to implement a strategy and to develop a style within this squad, just given how difficult it's been for the previous managers to do anything with them?
Well, I suppose that's one of the major issues there. I mean, someone put to me recently about Manchester United, and it's a little bit like Everton, actually. They've become a squad that have got used to seeing out managers, which doesn't necessarily create the best culture. And I think that's why Rangnick was in a difficult situation from the off, because they knew he wasn't going to be the permanent manager, so that immediately erodes some of his authority. But second to that, like I was just before their Champions League match against Atletico Madrid, the first leg, I had to do a big piece in all of this. And so I was talking to a lot of people around United, and it was put to me that one of the biggest frustrations Rangnick had was that he was basically trying to... Stephen mentioned there about identity, and this is one of the points of the Rangnick appointment. It was a first step to finally introduce a kind of a playing ideology to about, and something modern, because Solskjaer didn't have that, Mourinho didn't have that. And so they want something along the lines of what Liverpool do, and what pretty much is best practice at the top of the game now, a really high-pressing game, or as Rangnick himself puts it on the training ground, he calls it ball-oriented pressing. But apparently, when he tried to do this, he found that because most of his squad has played through Mourinho and then Solskjaer, they basically had no experience of any sort of coaching in this. So it was like having to retrain the squad anew. And really, that's kind of, it can be anything up to an 18-month job or whatever the time is, because as they put it, it's an educational process, something you're not going to do in a few months. And so I think that's an immediate challenge for Ten Hag, given that at the very least, he would be along the same kind of branch of football philosophy, if you like, as Rangnick. But I suppose at the very least as well, he's starting with the players knowing that he's the head coach. He can be, from people you speak to, he can be a bit of a control freak, Ten Hag. Not necessarily the most charismatic figure in that regard, but knows what he wants. And at least the players know that he is now the boss. He's not just someone standing in. So I suppose that's one advantage in what's actually going to be quite a big job on the training ground alone.
Stephen, like, you've obviously been in professional football environments. Like, should it take that long? If you just look what Jurgen Klopp is able to do with the likes of Jota and Diaz, and, you know, he can get them playing the way that he wants them to play pretty quickly. Should it take 18 months to get a team doing what you want them to do?
I don't think you can compare exactly with Jurgen Klopp. Obviously, Jurgen Klopp's had a bit of time there to develop Liverpool's way of playing. And when he does sign a player, it's more often than not, every player that comes in makes an impact in the team. And he doesn't kind of sign players just for the sake of it. But I think Ten Hag has to look at this Man United team and totally change the mindset of them. I'll give you an example of the game the other night. And a little bit like Miguel said there, like that kind of Mourinho era and into Solskjaer, where Mourinho was a little bit more kind of, he'd sit back a little bit and kind of go on the break a little bit rather than that front foot press. I seen Thiago pick the ball up in the halfway line the other night, and Wan-Bissaka, if he had kind of been on the front foot a couple of yards, he could have nipped in and nicked the ball off him. But instead, he turned his back and he kind of ran back into his position. Whereas, I'll give you the example of the Liverpool's final goal, and Harry Maguire tried the ball into the young lad that came on, and I can't remember his name, but Robertson stepped in on the front foot and won the ball back in the kind of offensive area, and Liverpool go and score. And I'm not saying you have to play exactly like Liverpool, but that for me stood out massively in my head, the mindset of the players. They don't know what they're doing at Man United at the moment. They're kind of stuck in the middle of something, and in the end you don't really get very much out of it. And this season alone, you go back to Cristiano, and if they hadn't had Cristiano Ronaldo this year, like, I'm not saying he's going to stay on definitely at the club, but they didn't have him this year, they'd be miles off the Champions League places. So there's big changes needed there, and I think I'll take. I do think I'll take a long time, Maria. I think 18 months. I think he'd be doing very well if he can turn around in 18 months. I think he needs a good 3-4, maybe even 5 years to kind of totally change the squad mindset, the players coming in, and he needs to be given that time. But like Miguel said there, it's good that he now finally have a manager. He mentioned there he might be a bit of a control freak. That, I think that's a good thing, because looking from the outside, then nobody was taking control at Man United. It was kind of everybody was doing what he wanted. So at least now they have a figurehead, and if you're a player, you're going into the club, you know he's the manager, he's the boss, and that's the way it should be. And I think that's, in teams I've always been in, I always felt like the manager was the boss and you didn't want to do anything to let them down. And I think he needs to get that right at Man United. And listen, good luck to him. If he can do it, it'll be great for the club.
Miguel, Stephen mentioned Ronaldo there. Do you think that he has a future at the club under Ten Hag?
I suppose that's one of the biggest questions, especially there's almost been a two-sides thing with Ronaldo here in terms of his influence on United, where, yes, I think the only reason they're in with a shout of Champions League football is because of his goals. But then there's the question, can you actually play anything close to modern football with Ronaldo as he is at the age of 37? I mean, it's something that Rangnick, I know, actually sometimes struggled with, and I'll have to compromise his way for Ronaldo. So it's going to be very interesting to see what Ten Hag does with it. It's one of the major decisions. And I mean, on the other side, if Manchester United don't get Champions League, would Ronaldo himself, would he be possibly investigating a way out? Because, I mean, we do know he has a lot of professional pride. And he is a player who doesn't like being seen on the bench. So to be outside the Champions League it's going to be a negative enough for him. So I think that's, to be honest, very much up in the air. He does have a contract for another year at least, but it's certainly uncertain right now.
Well, where could you see him going?
Well, I mean, funny, I think that's wood, because there's going to be a little bit of a merry-go-round of forwards this summer. We've obviously got, everyone expects Haaland to go to either Manchester City or Real Madrid. It'll probably be Manchester City. Mbappe may go to Real Madrid. Then if Atletico Madrid don't get Champions League, João Felix could be available, because they'll actually need the money. That could create a few openings. And I suppose the obvious choice might be, if he was to leave, and it would be if Mbappe goes to Madrid. You can imagine with the way Paris Saint-Germain are run, and how much of their policy, like rather shamefully I would say, is built on kind of almost the glamour around the club. You would appeal to them to put Messi and Ronaldo together for the first time, albeit both in their late 30s. So I think that could be a possibility. I don't think Ronaldo would be interested yet in going, say, to, as people put it, one of the retirement leagues.
Yeah, I can imagine the jersey sales, all right, and the amount of interest from kids these days anyway in a PSG with Ronaldo and Messi. I can see why they would want to do that, all right. Let's very quickly move on to Arsenal and Chelsea. Stephen, just given Arsenal's run of form and the little bit of expectation that was on them for a while, how significant was that win over Chelsea last night?
I think it was a massive win. Obviously, they've got a rivalry there, Chelsea and Arsenal. But for Arsenal to go away at Stamford Bridge and score 4 goals, it was huge for them. And I think it might give them that confidence now. After losing 3 on the bounce, they'll be feeling a lot better about themselves. Mikel Arteta will be feeling a lot better about himself kind of going into these final games. And like we mentioned earlier on, this final Champions League spot, it could go anywhere, it really could, because we're talking about Manchester City and Liverpool in the title race, saying any kind of drop points and that could be the other team kind of going on and winning the league, because them two teams are that good. But I think the teams below them, like I think Spurs, Arsenal, Man United will drop a lot more points before the end of the season, so it really is hard to call who's going to achieve that. But Arsenal, after beating Chelsea last night, albeit Chelsea were maybe kind of a little bit after the cup semi finally might have been totally at their best, but I still think it's going to be go right to the wire. And again, it's one that I genuinely couldn't call now, because the way teams are dropping points and winning games, like without being in any even form, I didn't expect Arsenal to go there last night and win. So it just goes to show you don't know what to expect, and whoever gets it, it'll be huge for whoever goes in, because the money and the to attract players, you've got to be playing Champions League football, and both all Spurs, Arsenal, Man United, they really need to be in that kind of Champions League if they want to be where they are.
Yeah, that's for sure. And just on Manchester City before we finish up, Miguel, they didn't drop points last night. There was a tiny little bit of hope from Liverpool fans that maybe Brighton might be able to put it up to them. Are we looking at them thinking they're going to drop points at any stage, do you reckon?
My feeling, I was at the Chelsea Arsenal game and watched City afterwards. My feeling though was that was actually a bit of an instruction as to how this title race will go. The games might start off edgy just because of the pressure to win, but I think for both Liverpool and City, they'll have too much quality to bear in most of the matches. And I also think that'll be a real release for City last night, especially after how Saturday went in the FA Cup semi-final, even if it was a mostly second string side. It was basically almost just a kind of a reminder of their quality. And I think we could well see another 2018-19 title race where they both almost win every game.
OK, well, that's not really good news if you're a Liverpool fan. But sure, look, that's the way it is, Miguel. We will finish on that. Thank you so much for joining us, and Stephen Elliott as well. We will no doubt be talking to you a little bit more often over the next few weeks as that title race does heat up. Now, before we head for a break, we have our Punchestown competition. So the Punchestown Festival returns from Tuesday the 26th to Saturday the 30th of April. And 2FM will be there as we enjoy one of Ireland's favourite social and sporting events. To celebrate, we have two pairs of Flexi reserved enclosure tickets each day this week. Enjoy all the extras of the reserved enclosure, which is the social hub of the event, with amazing trackside viewing, great live music, bars and style. So to be in with the chance to win, just answer the following question. In which county does the Punchestown Festival take place? Text your answer, your name, your county and your email address to 51552. As always, RTE competition terms and conditions apply. See 2fm.ie for details.
RTE
2FM.
On
2FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. We are turning our attention to Gaelic games. Bernard Jackman is with me in studio as we will be chatting rugby a little bit later on. But first of all, we are going to talk Gaelic football. Former Electric Ireland GAA Minor Championship star Stephen MacDonald is with me as Electric Ireland GAA Minor Championship was launched today. And Stephen will look back at his own minor moments from playing with Armagh. So Stephen, I am delighted to be chatting to you. Well, I was for a while, and then I realised that you now have a son who's playing minor, which means everybody's getting old.
I'm certainly getting older, that's for sure. It doesn't seem that long ago that I was lined out for the county minors myself, but time moves on, unfortunately, and this weekend my son will be lined out for the county as well.
That's pretty amazing though. Okay, it's amazing that you have a son that old, but also just that he's followed in your footsteps, because anyone that's been involved in sport or GA, whatever, like, it's not an easy thing to do, to one, have a famous dad, or two, to even be playing county minor.
No, and to be fair, he's done it on his own accord. I've totally stayed away from coaching him down through the years. Maybe he spent 6 months, but that was possibly about it, at under 13, under 14 level. But outside of that there, he's been working away with various coaches in the club and in the county, and he's more or less taught himself how to play, so that's encouraging.
So did you make a conscious decision just to not coach him? Was that kind of like your philosophy as a parent?
Well, sometimes you can have the added pressure of what your father or mother achieved, and that sometimes might get the best out of them then. And listen, there was never any pressure on me growing up and playing football as a young fella, so I just wanted the same type of release for himself as well.
So tell us, where is he playing? What position?
Well, as far as I know, the team's not named. I don't ask him any questions, so the game is on Saturday.
In general, where does he play?
He normally plays in the forward lane, and he has worn number 13 jersey once or twice. So.
Okay, so he is actually literally following in your footsteps then.
Well, listen, he's a forward. He's probably more naturally gifted in the half-forward lane than what I was, but you can probably throw him anywhere in the forward lane and he'll adapt to it all right.
Fair play. And we wish him all the best of luck at the weekend. But, like, just even in general, like, playing that
playing for the county at underage level and, you know, being in those big games on the big day, how beneficial is it that for young players coming through, do you find?
Absolutely. Listen, it's very important for, I suppose, their future self-development. From my point of view, looking back on my career, particularly as a minor footballer, you know, we were fortunate enough that back then the minor games took place just before the senior games, and particularly in the second half, you're experiencing playing in front of a massive audience, a huge crowd, and that was packing into the stadiums, and that was something brilliant for us to achieve so early on in our career. You know, you get the opportunity to represent your county at a high level, and you see, you know, what it takes to go and perform at that type of level. Nowadays, you have the added bonus of, you know, having gym programs done for you, dietary plans made out for you, and we something that we didn't have when we were county minors, but certainly it's an advantage that the young fellas have and young girls have nowadays growing up, and, you know, it bodes well for their future because it gives them a good platform to build, I suppose, for senior football or camogie or whatever it may be.
And I'd imagine as well that a lot of counties have learned lessons from the past just in terms of that step up between underage, minor and into senior, that it's a lot more cohesive now, because so often you've heard of you know, counties winning 3 and 4 All-Ireland and under at minor or 21 level and not bringing any players through. Are things set up well in Armagh?
Yeah, well, there's a good system in place over the last number of years, spearheaded by Aidan O'Rourke and Paul McGrain, two ex-teammates of myself. So they've been doing tremendous work there, and, you know, the fruits of that hopefully we may see in the next couple of years with players coming through and making it into the senior ranks. I managed the under-21 squad 6 or 7 years ago, and I think there's 8 or 9 of those players are regular starters now for the senior team. So that's also encouraging as well, that there is a level of players producing the goods at underage level and making it into the squads and then taking a step up to senior grade as well.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Because even last week I was looking at one of the Clare Hurling underage teams, and a couple of the lads who'd won All-Irelands in the 90s had sons playing. It's just brilliant to see that generation coming through. I'm sure it's the same for you guys now as well. It's lovely, I have to say, to see the next generation coming through. But let's look at this weekend, because we do have some absolutely cracking matches coming, and we have to start with Donegal and Armagh in Ballybofey. And the lead up to this, of course, has been very much dominated by the decision by the Central's Appeals Committee to quash bans handed out to Stephen Campbell, Kieran Mackin and Adrian Nugent and Rian O'Neill as well. Just from the Armagh point of view, like, I suppose the boost of having these players back, it's hard to even describe.
Yeah, listen, in the build-up to any championship game, you don't want any unnecessary distractions. And, you know, the last couple of weeks has been a distraction for Armagh and for Donegal as well. And you want to be going into championship matches watching the best players available. And certainly some of those players that you named, Stephen Campbell, Rian O'Neill, they're exceptional talents, Aidan Nugent as well, all exceptional footballers. And from an Armagh point of view, we want to see the best player put out in front of us, and that gives us the best chance of possibly winning the game. And, you know, I don't think we're wrong in saying that the likes of Rian O'Neill is regarded as one of the better footballers in the country at the minute. And, you know, it would be an absolute disaster if we had been going into this game without him.
Yeah, Donegal had a few players suspended as well, but opted not to appeal those bans. They're probably regretting it now, though, just looking at the way this has played out. But just given the fact that the CAC did quash these suspensions, do you think that we have a problem with the way the disciplinary system is run within the GAA?
Listen, it's been an ongoing problem down through the years. I remember as far back as when I was playing in the mid-noughties, you know, there were a few high-profile incidents where players were getting suspensions overturned, and it's something that has to be definitely looked at. I've been saying this for quite a while, that some help and support has to be offered to the referees as well, and whether it's taking in a second referee to help officiate in games, I've experienced that with the international rules. It's something that works efficiently and effectively in that game, so why not trial it in our own games, where one referee can officiate one half and the other referee officiates the other half? I think what's expected nowadays in terms of the quality of performance that we are expecting from 30 players, it's hard for one person in the middle of the park to officiate all of that.
Yeah, well, as you said, I think it's probably a conversation that we've been having for a long time and probably will be having a few more times over the next few months as well, just about officials and suspensions and all the different CCCs and CACs and how they operate and decisions that were made. And it's an unfortunate part of it, but it is definitely a part of the GAA that is comes into focus when Championship comes around. And just in terms of this Armagh team then, Stephen, like, how good do you think they are? How much potential do you think they have, and how far do you think they're going to get in this Championship?
Over the last couple of years, I've probably been bigging them up too much and we fell flat on our face, so I don't want to say too much about them, but I've been impressed with them throughout the National League. First and foremost, they maintained their status and with some style. They could have qualified for a league final up until the last day, so that was very important for the further development of this particular squad. The games that they didn't pick up results in, they were still competitive in, and they had opportunities to win a few of those games. Probably the Kerry game, apart from that game, was the only game where they looked second best throughout. So I would say we're in a good place going into this game. The team seem to be brimming with confidence at the minute, and they know that it's going to be a tough task going into Ballybofey on Sunday. It's never ever easy, and Donegal have a fantastic record up there, so if you're going to win Ulster titles, you have to beat the best, and Donegal have been producing it over the last decade in Ulster football. So for Armagh to go and finally get that monkey off their back, they're going to have to beat the likes of Donegal.
Yeah, and when it comes to Ulster football, there's so many cliches about the style played up there and what it's like, and you know how difficult it can be to watch at times, although that seems to be changing. And when you think of this Armagh team and how attack-minded they have been over the last while, what kind of a game are you expecting now between Armagh and Donegal?
Listen, it's going to be cagey at the start, there's no doubt, but I think the attack and flair of both teams will come to the fore. I look at Donegal's inside line, and if Michael Murphy is playing in there alongside Jamie Brennan and Paddy McBrady, that's as an exciting line as what you'll see in Gaelic football. And if they can utilise that to their strengths in football in there, then they will cause a level of damage as well. At the other end of the field, you know, we'd be excited about the prospect of the likes of Ryan O'Neill, Rory Grugan, Aidan Nugent and Stephen Campbell maybe being sprung from the bench and doing what he's done throughout the course of the National League campaign, which is scoring points when sprung. And you would think that, you know, it would be a day for forwards, particularly if it's good weather, that it won't be the normal cagey, dire affair that we've seen of some games in Ulster. I wouldn't say all games. Mm-hmm. I think Ulster football is certainly moving in the right direction. I think both of these teams, if given the opportunity, tend to play football the right way.
I like the sound of that, a day for the forwards. Now, we are on our Easter holidays, but we're in Championship, so I think it's fair enough to start talking about the Sam Maguire. Who do you think is going to be walking the steps of the Hogan when the Championship does end?
Listen, I would love to be able to say Armagh with great confidence, but I think probably 95% of the county or the country are thinking along the lines of Kerry. They've been very, very impressive in their National League campaign. They went and won Division 1. They've got the likes of David Clifford and Sean O'Shea, two exceptionally good forwards in their team. And I just think they will learn a lot from their defeat to Tyrone last year in the All-Ireland semi-final, and they will improve from that there. And having, I suppose, while a lot of those guys have won national titles at underage level, getting the monkey off their back from winning a National League title will be a step forward for them, and I think they'll definitely utilise that and kick on.
Okay, thank you so much, Stephen, and best of luck to your son. I didn't actually ask you his name at the start. I just called him your son, which is a terribly rude thing to do.
No problem at all. His name's Keelan.
Grant, we'll be keeping an eye out for him over the next few years, so best of luck to him when he does play that minor game at the weekend, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, take care.
2FM.
Game on
2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's new added benefits range is enriched with all your B vitamins, which are essential for your health and well-being. Available in store now.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. It is time to talk rugby. I'm delighted to say that I am joined on the line by Alison Donnelly of Scrum Queens. Alison, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. As always, on a Thursday ahead of the Women's Six Nations, we'll be chatting about that shortly. But first, we're going to get into the URC with Bernard Jackman, who is with me in studio. Bernard, interestingly enough, the URC announced today that the grand final will take place at the home venue of the highest ranked team, where the first ever URC champions will be crowned. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, look, I think it's an extra incentive. This is the most competitive running we've had in years in this competition. I know it's a different format, but in terms of the domestic competition for the Celtic Nations, and now obviously we've got the South Africans added, so it's very, very tight. Leinster have a little bit of they have a nice buffer of 10 points, but if you look at the squad they've sent to South Africa, they've left a lot of their internationals at home, so they may not pick up points or many points in South Africa on this tour, and then they'd be left with a home game against Munster to make sure they finish top. But it certainly gives a carrot to the likes of Ulster and Glasgow, who would have a realistic chance of trying to finish first, or would have hopes of finishing first, and then obviously hoping to keep that seeding all the way through to get a home final. But everyone was wondering where the final was going to be, and I just think we've got a little bit of clarity today. Now, having said that, Leinster, if they finish first, could lose in the knockout stages, and then someone else is seeding pulls through. So you just get a little bit of a picture of what the final might look at. And but underneath Leinster, I mean, it's so competitive. And looking at Munster's fixtures, their match tomorrow night in Ulster is very, very important for them.
Yeah. So what you're saying, Bernard, is it's all to play for.
Yeah, no, it is all to play for. And even, I mean, you know, the South African teams who had a slow start are now really getting momentum with, you know, the Sharks, the Stormers and the Bulls all in the top eight, which is probably what this competition needed, to be honest. And now it's up to the Welsh in particular to, you know, get their act together and be more competitive, because now they're going to lose out on Champions Cup qualification. And if they don't improve, that'll be year-on-year effect for them, and that'll reduce their competitiveness and reduce their finance, etc. So questions being asked of particularly the Welsh. The Scots, in fairness, Glasgow and Edinburgh are in the top eight at the moment, so they've rallied and are much stronger than they have been over the last couple of years.
And do you think that it's still, like, has the status improved now? Do you think that the teams they want to win it more than ever before?
Yeah, no, I do, and I think it's going to get even better and better. I think South Africa were rushed into it. They came to the Northern Hemisphere, you know, early season, not really equipped, hadn't played many friendlies, didn't really understand the style of play, what's required to win. I think you've seen as they've come back, you know, into 2022, this side of Christmas, little glimpses of they've improved their understanding. Plus, they're recruiting really heavy for next year. The Sharks, for example, you know, have signed Estebet. They're rumoured to be talking to Lou Diager. More Springboks are now talking to South African franchises rather than just going to Japan. So, I think this is going to be a much better league over the next couple of years.
Okay, well, that sounds very, very promising. So there are some games this weekend. Munster have made 7 changes for that game against Ulster. Notably, there is no Peter Mahoney or Simon Zebo.
Yeah, I think Peter Mahoney, 6-day turnaround. He went off last week holding his shoulder. He had a massive performance. You know, I didn't really like Zebo. They haven't said clarified what's wrong with him, why he's dropped out. But they still have a very strong squad. You know, Farrell, Keith Earls, Demi Delande, Joey Carby and Craig Casey are the starting halfbacks. So I thought they looked really good with Casey off the bench last week, and Carberry had a really good game. And, you know, then Alex Kendellan's getting a chance to start in a back row with John Hodnett and Jack O'Donoghue. And special mention for Jack O'Donoghue, I think he's been outstanding this year. Obviously he's captain tomorrow night, but he's so unlucky that there's so many good back rows in Ireland that he's not playing for the national team. But in terms of what he's doing for Munster week in, week out, he's been outstanding.
And Ulster have made 3 changes, and most notably Lowry going to 10.
Yeah, look, I think that's probably the most exciting positional switch of the weekend across the URC. And like, he has so much potential. Obviously he's got cap for Ireland now at fullback and looked really good. But the young backs that Ulster have, Stuart Moore is, of you know, playing fullback again, Ballacloon. I like Eaton McElroy on the wing, and you'd imagine that Lowry will certainly keep Munster's fringe defence busy, because he's such a threat taking the ball to the line, and really fascinating to see. And I look at Ulster, there'll be a little bit of a hangover from last weekend. They'll be gutted to lose to Toulouse, but if they win tomorrow night, they're in pole position to get second seed, and I think they'll rally and, you know, should be good enough to beat Munster.
Is it as easy as that, though? Like, when you do suffer a really disappointing loss, the mental drain of it is probably savage, dealing with that disappointment. Can you just bounce back? Like, will they be able to do it?
It's a real test of their mentality, their resilience. I think in some ways they have to. I mean, Munster, you could argue, have a quarter-final against Toulouse, you know, in the back of their mind. Ulster at home, I think the fans will appreciate, you know, the effort they put in over those two legs, and only lost to Toulouse by a very narrow margin over two legs. So I think they will. I think being at home is a massive for them, and they always seem to respond to that Ravenhill crowd. And you know, McFarland is doing a good job up there. They are getting better, and I think that they will be they'll bounce back tomorrow night. And the best way of getting over it is to go out and put a good performance in and get a win.
Yeah, for sure. So Leinster are playing the Chelsea Sharks down in South Africa. You mentioned that they hadn't sent the best squad that they possibly could. How do you think they're going to fare?
Look at that. When you look at the squad, but then you, it obviously looks quite weak, some young players, but then you actually draft what their first choice 15 could be, and it's actually very strong. So you still have, you know, lots of internationals. Andrew Porter's gone down. So they can have a very good side, and you know, Leinster have traditionally been able to win no matter who they put out. So I think it's going to be hard for them. As I said, the South Africans are showing a little bit of form. The Sharks aren't. It's at sea level. That's the one I think that they'll fancy the most, and they may send home the likes of Porter and Kelleher after that to get back and start preparing for Leicester. But I think they've got enough of a cushion that, you know, one win would be a brilliant result for them over there.
And what about Connacht and the Emirates Lions?
Yeah, that's two loose teams, two crazy teams in terms of how they play. Neither team are stacked defensively. And look, at Connacht have nothing really to play for. I think they've lost their chance of qualifying. And it's important for them, though, that they do get some decent performances, or else this end of season could really, you know, go out with a whimper.
Okay, well, lots of exciting ties there. Intriguing, you could say, over the weekend. But now let's turn our attention to the women's game. Alison Donnelly joins us on the line now. Ali, before we get into the weekend's action, some news from New Zealand, and the Black Ferns have confirmed their new coaching structure ahead of the World Cup, with the director of rugby being Wayne Smith and the assistant coaches Wesley Clark and Whitney Hansen. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the changes have been rather forced on them, because, you know, Glenmore resigned in the wake of that very negative review about the team culture. But I think it's a really, you know, it's for the next 6 months, what a great group. Isn't Graham Henry's helping out, Mike Cron's helping out. I mean, Wayne Smith's one of the best tactical coaches in the game, in the men's game primarily, and now into the women's game. So I think it's exciting, because the Black Ferns were so off the boil last autumn when they came over here. They were hammered by England twice, hammered by France twice. Something drastic needed to happen. So since they've gone back, they've been made professional. That's one big box tick. And now they've got someone like Wayne Smith guiding them through short term. But who knows, you know, what he can kind of help them to achieve. So I think it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it really is. And that's going to come around really, really quickly as well. I think we'll be able to be talking about it shortly enough. By the time the Six Nations is over, it'll be full steam ahead. But let's look at this weekend and the daunting task that is facing Ireland, having to take on a pretty invincible-looking England.
Yeah, I think this is the best England team we've ever seen. I think they're just, you know, the role that they're on in terms of the wins is one thing, but their strength and depth is just unbelievable. You know, nobody can actually name their best starting team, to be honest. I tried recently, I maybe got two positions. And so that's difficult. And I also think this is there's two ways of looking at it. It's a great time to play them because you can test yourself. It's going to be a massive crowd in Welford Road. Or it's a terrible time to play them. They're finessing leading up to a World Cup, which they expect to win. You know, they've got strength and depth. They're on this 21, you know, game winning streak. So, yeah, I think you said daunting. That's definitely the word. It's going to be an incredibly tough game for Ireland.
Yeah, it really will. And I think probably the squad announcement from Ireland has really brought into sharp focus just how difficult it's going to be with some of their key players heading over to the sevens and the 15s, just trying to put together a team, really. It does feel like that.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing now is the sort of hangover from decisions that were made previously that are now being addressed as a result of all the changes that we're seeing. But yeah, I think I was pretty disappointed when I saw how many players, seven players being taken out to go off to Canada to play sevens next weekend. I mean, I think it's important to say that round of the World Series, there's nothing riding on it from Ireland's perspective. You know, they're not going to get relegated. They're definitely, you know, they're almost certainly going to qualify for the World Cup, given how many spots are up to grabs for Europe. So I don't really understand the need to take so many out, having put them in there in the first place, you know. So that's frustrating, and I think unintentional, but the IRFU have sort of devalued the Women's Six Nations because it's been on such a high this year. The crowds are amazing, the TV coverage is amazing, the standards improving, and now we've got this sort of showpiece match and one team's turning up with half their team heading off to another country. So that's frustrating, and it would be great if we could get some kind of understanding of that strategy, because, you know, it's not really fair on Greg McWilliams to have to explain it. He's got enough, mm-hmm. He's got a big job on his hands as it is. So I don't really understand it, and I think it's quite disappointing. It's going to be tough. You know, we're asking players who've come out of the league, All-Ireland League, who haven't played in the Six Nations, to go and play England. That's, you know, that's incredibly tough, you know, just in terms of the standard jump alone from club to international, not to mind England. So yeah, it's all very odd and slightly frustrating, but on the plus side, it will be a great occasion to be part of.
Yeah, really will. But I think it probably also really highlights just how small that playing base here is in Ireland. And you would hope that behind the scenes there is something being done to address it, and it's not just a case of the band-aid being put on over and over again and history repeating itself and situations not being improved.
Yeah, and in fairness, I think things are changing. Now, it's taking time, obviously, but we saw the commitments that were made after the review kind of process finished a couple of months ago into the national team, and those changes are going to take time to bed in. But undoubtedly, you know, we've got to have a bigger playing pool, and whoever comes in as that new, they've created this new role, kind of head of performance pathways. That's really important job, and whoever comes in there is going to have to, you know, they've got their work cut out for them. I suppose what's slightly kind of puzzling is, if we knew we were going to lose the players these two games, why we hadn't sort of mixed and matched some of those coming in now completely cold. That seems unusual. It suddenly seems like a gaping hole instead of what might have been just kind of a gap here and there. So, yeah, it's all very strange. And you know, I'm really looking forward to being at the game and being in the crowd and experiencing a massive, likely to be a record Women's Six Nations crowd over there. But I do fear for the scoreline and for the experience of those new players coming in.
Yeah, it's a real difficult situation for all of them involved. But look, hopefully that it'll go okay and they'll be able to mount some sort of a challenge. Ali, before we let you go, I heard it's your birthday and I thought to myself, what would Ali Darley love for her birthday? And all I could think of was a happy birthday from Bernard Jackman.
Happy birthday, Ali. I'm sure that's not what you want, but I won't leave you hanging. Oh, happy birthday. Have a great night.
The absolute best present. I'm glad we got to the rugby, because I'm heading off for dinner now, so it's been great to speak to you.
Enjoy, Ali. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks a million. Bye, guys. Bye.
RTE.
2FM.
Game on.
On 2FM. With Green Farm. Green Farm's newest chicken and turkey range is full of B vitamins, which play a vital role in maintaining good health and well-being. Available in store now.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. We do have our competition winner. The question was, which county is the Punchestown Festival held in? And the answer is, of course, County Kildare. And the winner today is Kay Condon from Waterford. So Kay is getting those two tickets to next week's festival. Now, let's turn our attention to swimming and join John Kenny, who is at the Irish Open Championships. It is day three. John, it sounds like the women's 100 was a pretty good race.
It was, because Danielle Hill lowered the Irish record, the second Irish senior record of the week, winning that blue ribbon, the 100 freestyle. The Tokyo Olympian bettering her own best time by 0.46 of a second. 54.87 seconds, the new Irish record in the evening final. Hill led from the off, heading fastest qualifiers Vicky Catterson and Erin Reardon. And never looked like being caught, leading at the 50 mark before going on to claim her third national title of the week to add to the 53 and the 200 backstroke titles she's already won this week. And then, to cap off a very good day for her, she's just won her fourth victory of the week, the final race of the day. She's won the women's 50 metres butterfly in 26.82 seconds. That's, in fact, just outside Mona McShire's Irish record. Good swim, that, from Hill. Julian Knox is currently training in the George Washington University in the USA. He arrived into this meet on Wednesday night, won a thrilling women's 400 metres individual medley, hunting down Temple Oaks' Molly Main in the last leg in the freestyle to take the gold in 4 minutes, 52.43 seconds. And in the best of the men's finals, Max McCusker of Dolphin, who swims out of Florida State, won his third gold medal of the week, taking victory in the men's 100 metres butterfly in 52.63 seconds, just 0.11 of a second shy of Shane Ryan's Irish senior record. So very good day all round for some, perhaps, of the lesser lights. Obviously, Danielle Hill, we know, is a Tokyo Olympian, but Max McCusker certainly is coming through this week. Liam Custer, incidentally, won the men's 800 freestyle, a new Irish junior record, almost 7 seconds off Daniel Whiffen's three-year-old best in that 800 freestyle final.
John Kenny, as always, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for that update. That is all we have time for this evening. Bernard Jackman, thank you as well for coming in.
Thank you.
Pleasure as always. Tara Kumar is up next.